maintains the position that 26-10-25 is not applicable to the appellant's claim. I'm going to touch on that briefly. Of course, SDCL 26-10-25, by legislative definition, is based on, it applies to any civil action based on intentional conduct brought by any person for recovery of damages for injuries suffered as a result of childhood sexual abuse. A complaint, particularly as it relates to the appellants presently before this court, specifically alleges sexual abuse as to each one of the appellants. All the evidence on file as to them, including the answer to interrogatories, the grid that's attached to the original complaint and the amended complaint and the affidavits address that. So, enough said on that issue. Judge Zell ruled that because there was no specific information provided by the plaintiffs, SDCL 26-10-25 cannot provide an exception to the statute of limitations defense against the plaintiff's claims based on sexual abuse. However, 26-10-25 is not an exception. It's a statute of limitations providing for the three-year limitation based on making the causal connection. And it's a two-prong, whichever is later, it's a two-prong injury or condition. There's a reason why the legislature has injury or condition, whichever applies later. I won't, again, address what the court has enunciated. This court has enunciated in the Strantmeier decision as being the policy as it articulates and construes behind 26-10-25. Suffice it to say, it recognizes the delay, the self-consuming nature, as I've addressed previously, and the inability of the plaintiff to perceive the consequences, to make that causal connection because of the traumatic nature of childhood sexual abuse. That provides the application and construction, I think, sufficiently for 26-10-25. The summary judgment hearing, at the summary judgment hearing, the defendant appellees focused their attacks on memory of the act rather than the causal connection. They never raised the causal connection. There was only one deposition taken that was noticed by the defendants. Then it had to be re-noticed by me so they would take my client's deposition. There were only two sets of interrogatories sent out by them. They were only directed to whether or not the memory was repressed of sex abuse and whether that memory, when that memory was recovered. And that's it. At the hearing on the motion for summary judgment, Judge Zell even asked counsel, isn't it about connecting the injury or the condition rather than whether they have a memory of the childhood sexual abuse? Counsel said yes, and yet it still wasn't addressed. The time of the discovery of causal connection was never addressed by the appellees at any time in there. It wasn't briefed, it wasn't argued, it wasn't a subject of any discovery. Going back to the burden of proof for a moment, Judge Zell ruled that the plaintiffs had not presented evidence that they discovered or reasonably should have discovered the injury or condition was caused by the act within 3 years of filing suit.
Isn't he right on that?
Yes. Well, I'm sorry.
Isn't he right on that statement?
I don't believe he's right, although I don't think it matters, Justice Savers. I can address that now or later.
Okay. Even if it's a statute of limitations instead of an exception, you know, assuming you're right on that, you still need to show, don't you? Unless you're saying you don't have the burden of proof. But just because they fail to bring it up in depositions or interrogatories or whatever, doesn't mean when they've come at you the way they have that you don't have to show the causal connection.
Your Honor, I believe that it goes back to for instance, the case of Cody versus Leapley, where the court held that statute of limitation must be established as an uncontroverted fact. And another case would be Ray versus Downs, by this court that the defendants there obtained motion for summary judgment, which was reversed because they didn't sustain the burden of proof on the assumption of risk, the affirmative defense. And in a summary judgment proceeding, even if it was not their burden, and it is their burden because it's an affirmative defense, they would still have to at least point out the defects in the plaintiff's case. And there were no defects in the plaintiff's case. They, since it was their burden, they had to go beyond that and presumptively establish that affirmative defense, Your Honor.
Well, let's back up. Let's back up just a half a step.
Yes.
About whose burden it was. Under Conway versus Conway, didn't the burden shift to you to identify a fact that was a disputed fact for trial? Because we've got a case here where nobody's been involved with this school for almost 30 years, and no one's been there. They've closed the school, turned it over to somebody else. 30 years later, a lawsuit starts. Isn't that a presumptive showing? And under Conway, the burden then shifts to you. And to follow up on Justice Sabers, what fact did you identify then that would indicate there was a dispute that should go to trial on the statute of limitations?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the last three words.
On the statute of limitations.
Again, Your Honor, I believe that the fact that it is an affirmative defense.
I got to stop you right there.
Yes,
because
Your Honor.
It is an affirmative defense, but in Conway versus Conway, we clearly said that if the defendants make a presumptive showing, the burden shifts to the plaintiffs.
Yes, Your Honor.
So let's go from there.
They did not make a presumptive showing.
Okay.
That's my point. They didn't point out even, and really under Celotex, and by the way, I think they miscite Celotex, in my humble opinion, its holding is limited to a situation where the non-movement bears the burden at trial. But in this case, let's assume that we had the burden. They still have to point out what the defects are. They never pointed out. They didn't even discuss 26-10-25. They only talked about repression of memory. In fact, it wasn't until what they call our boilerplate cookie-cutter affidavits were filed with the court that someone, to prevent this exact thing that, and why we're here today, that being the plaintiffs, brought up the issue of the causal connection. It was never brought up by them, even after His Honor Judge Zell addressed that issue. Judge Zell was forced to act as their attorney to raise the issue and then rule on it, which, of course, is not permissible.
Well, but so, Judge Zell got it right.
He got it right, Your Honor. He got it right.
So how did he decide it wrong?
He decided it wrong because what he should have done, first of all, is he ruled on it sua sponte without giving us the opportunity to address that issue, to raise that issue. It was never addressed in their motions. Basically, their motions were motions to dismiss. They were not motions for summary judgment. They were filed early on.
But you filed 9 affidavits, probably more than that.
I'm sorry, how many, Your Honor?
Well, you filed a number,
yes.
A large number of affidavits, according to the record. They're apparently in response to the motion for summary judgment. So you did have an opportunity.
And it was not our burden to do that. We did have the opportunity. And again, the fact that we undertook to, in part, fulfill their obligation and redirect them, I don't think changes the fact that their motions, by their own admissions, all counsel, at least it was represented by Blue Cloud of Abbey, counsel for Blue Cloud of Abbey, that all they were speaking for all counsel. This is, in effect, they were motions to dismiss, 12b-6 in federal rule, 12b-5 in the state rules to dismiss on the face of the complaint. So that was the only thing that we are legally bound to deal with, given the fact that it's an affirmative defense. They didn't do their job. They didn't do any discovery, similar to the Maharishi case. And that leads me to the motion to amend.
Is there some point, though, I mean, you've got, as I understand, allegations going back to 1947. Isn't there some point where you as a plaintiff, when you know there's a statute of limitations, have to come forward with some information that fits within the statute? You know, in the last two cases we've had, well, the last one we had was Stratemeyer. That was a case where they sued an uncle who had been molesting them, and that was within 10 years after the last time he'd been molested. Well, you're talking here about allegations that go back 60 years.
Yeah.
Shouldn't we, in looking at this statute, make a reasonable interpretation of it that at some point there's a presumption, the presumption has to shift to the plaintiff to show that they fit within this statute? Or are you saying that just if you can live to be 120, then you can sue your school district for something that happened 100 years and claim that I just discovered it?
No, Your Honor, not at all. What I'm saying is that that would be a question of fact unless it was resolvable.
So no passage of time, you're saying that no passage of time would ever make that burden shift and create some kind of a presumption, no matter how long it was.
I don't think it's a question of passage of time, Your Honor, as much as it is the circumstances. And again, coming back to what's before the court here, we're going to have the difficulties, Your Honor's noted, if this case is reversed and remanded. We have issues of fact. In fact, we may be facing yet another battery of motions for summary judgment, in all likelihood, if the case is reversed and remanded. But at this point, given the fact that these motions were filed early on, no discovery whatsoever was done, their motions to dismiss on the face of the complaint, that it's incumbent, just if no other, for no other reason than a matter of fundamental fairness, to give the plaintiffs an opportunity to at least address a properly framed motion for summary judgment goes to the issue where they presented presumptively or at least pointed out to us the defects in our claim that under 26-10-25, there's not yet a causal connection being made between whether it's 2 years or 20 or 60 between the act of childhood sexual abuse and the condition and or injuries. So, I'm
struggling with, you know, I realize what you say is, you know, has some cogency, but I guess I'm struggling with, you know, why not, when you know that you're being challenged on the statute of limitations and you know that you have the, at some point you're going to have to show that your clients made this causal connection between the abuse and their present condition. Why not put that in? Well, I mean,
right.
You're in a, you call it a motion to dismiss, but this isn't a motion. This is a summary judgment, and you're supposed to come up with affidavits and facts to establish your case. Why not do it?
Well, again, you're right. It is, at least they call them motions to dismiss or motions for summary judgment, but again, they admitted they were motions to dismiss on the face of the pleadings. But I understand, you know, common sense would dictate, Justice Konenkamp, that what you're saying is true. But the law says that they have to point out. They have to point it out so that we can address it. It's not our obligation, given the fact, particularly since it is an affirmative defense. It's their burden of proof. They have to go beyond that and presumptively establish based upon the law articulated by this court. So given that, let's assume that we didn't do our job because common sense would dictate, well, look, you're going to have to deal with it. Why don't you put it in there? Here we are with 70 cases on file at that time. I came in to represent certain plaintiffs only, by the way. And what was filed in the terms of affidavit at least addressed the causal connection for the first time. And a motion to amend was requested and made to, if in fact we didn't meet our burden in opposing the motion for summary judgment, assuming it was not or they were not motions to dismiss, contrary to what counsel have indicated, then the general rule is in most jurisdictions that if in effect a motion for summary judgment is really a 12b6 or in the state of 12b5 motion, then the plaintiff should be given an opportunity to amend and address those issues. They just didn't do the job. They didn't even acknowledge the law of the state, 26-10-25. In fact, one of the appellees is still taking the position, in their brief at least, that 26-10-25 doesn't even apply. On its face, the case applies.
But you know, they're faced with claims of abuse and whatever kind of abuse, and in addition, they're faced with claims of sexual abuse. It seems to me you could have, and then they make a motion to dismiss. it seems to me you could have come into the trial court and said, let's postpone, let's continue any motion to dismiss until depositions are taken, interrogatories are given and answered, or you could have put in a detailed affidavit that would have set them right back on their heels because they couldn't even, for the purposes of a motion, they couldn't have even challenged the truth of the affidavit, could they?
Since you're right, and again, I have to say what Your Honor's saying makes perfect sense, but you have to look at the context of what happened here. You have 72 claims. I didn't file this complaint as 72 cases all in one claim. Someone else did that. However, that being done and that having been said, that's one of the reasons why I made the motion to sever. In order to come in with detailed affidavits, these claims would have to be individuated. I'm sure the court can appreciate the difficulty in having...
But I don't care if there's 300.
More affidavits.
I don't care if there's 300 complaints. Nothing prevents coming in with a detailed affidavit, does it?
No,
as to one plaintiff or another plaintiff?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And again, I can only say that given the fact that they were motions to dismiss, they didn't go to the issue, the specific issue, that the plaintiff should have been an opportunity at least to address issues that they addressed in their motions. If they're motions to dismiss, they're motions to dismiss. This is notice pleading state. The complaint was sufficient on its face to withstand.
2 minutes.
Thank you.
Mr. Yates, one quick question.
Yes.
You say you didn't have the opportunity and essentially didn't understand. That's what I'm hearing, what you were supposed to respond to. The briefs that were filed at the trial court are not usually part of the record here. If we were to order those briefs, would they suggest that you guys were talking about a 12B, in South Dakota it's a 12B5 motion,
yes,
rather than a motion for summary judgment, and you weren't talking about the statute of limitations, and you weren't talking about when they should have discovered the causal relationship or the injury? Are you saying that if we get those briefs, none of those things are discussed in there?
No, they were discussed.
Well, then you did know what was going on at the time.
Yes, but I think the proper opportunity, due process is the right word, but the proper opportunity, notice of the proper opportunity, and this court has, it's essentially a situation where because they didn't address it, and if no other reason than to hedge what was going on in there, in whatever, for whatever reason, tactically misconstruing it or inadvertently misconstruing the law in this state, they didn't address the issue. The mere fact that we, in our opposition, addressed it for the first time, I just don't think fundamental fairness should mean that the whole case should be thrown out because of that. I think the plaintiff should be given an opportunity to test the waters with respect to the validity of their claims. And since I'm so short on time, may I just briefly touch on fraudulent concealment. In DeLonga, the court pointed out there was fraudulent concealment pled and recognized by Judge Pearsall in the issue with respect to the concealment of and the hiding of Father MacArthur's continuous sexual misconduct known to Bishop Hawk, instance after instance. And
your time has expired. Thank you.
My time has expired. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
All right. Mr. Madsen, you have 5 minutes, sir.
Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, counsel, I want to start this morning by answering Justice Zinner's question about the briefs and the record and what one might expect to find if one looked at those briefs. Justice Zinner, those briefs are part of the record. This is an unusual case from the perspective of the record, and I'm sure the law clerks have had an opportunity to see it. And for a case that's really just gone through the summary judgment stage, it's quite extensive. It's full of the depositions, the affidavits, and pursuant to motions of counsel made at the trial record and agreements between the parties, the briefs are filed. This case is, was, and always has been a case about the statute of limitations. I represent the Sisters of the Blessed Sacrament, an order that came to the Marty Union School In the late 20s or the early 30s, at the request of Father Sylvester Eisenman to help run the boarding school, they remained there through the time that the school was turned over to the Ainton Sioux tribe to run, which occurred in the early 70s. So as the court pointed out in questioning of counsel earlier, we're dealing with claims that run back to a time perhaps with only the nine plaintiffs that remain in the case, sometime in the 40s, all the way up to the latest something could have occurred would have been the very early 70s.
I just want to go back to a procedural point, though, that counsel made. I understand you're saying the briefs addressed these issues, but as I understand, the trial judge made a decision that none of the defense counsel advocated. Is that right? The trial judge came up with his own interpretation of the statute and then ruled on his interpretation as opposed to one that had been advocated to him. Am I wrong on that?
It's difficult to say, Justice Kohnekamp. The summary judgment hearing was approximately 6 hours long and was just about exactly 2 years ago when that occurred. And I'm sure the transcript is part of the record as well. We don't think that Judge Zell made the wrong decision. I mean,
that's not my question. I understand that you appreciate his decision, but my question is, was it a decision that you advocated? Because he's saying this statute is an exception, and therefore the burden was on the plaintiffs, and the plaintiffs didn't meet their burden. Did someone advocate that for the defense?
I think it's fair to say that from the defense we advocated the position that the plaintiffs in the case had not come forward with specific evidence to trigger what would be and what we believe to be an exception in 26-10-25. That is that we just discovered in the nick of time to bring this case.
So your point is that if, regardless of whether this statute is an exception or a limitation statute, they still have to come up with something. That's your position either way. Is that right?
That's our position either way, Justice Tony. Yes. Either way. Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice.
Even though it's a motion to dismiss rather than a motion for summary judgment?
Justice Meyer-Henry, this was a motion for summary judgment because it was supported beyond the four corners of the pleadings. It was not just merely an attack on the complaint on its face, which I must stress is very long on historical rhetoric and short on specific facts. The complaint named no individual perpetrator. It specified no dates of any abuse. It did not specify what the act of abuse was. There were interrogatories. There were discovery that was conducted at the behest of the defendants to try to get at what these specifics were. And that's what became the basis of what presumptively demonstrated that these claims had to be time-barred because they would have occurred so long ago. At that point, and the point I want to make, because I'm very short on time, is this is a Rule 56E case. It's about what a plaintiff, a claimant, needs to do to defeat a summary judgment based on a statute of limitations. And that very simply is to come forward with the specific evidence, a specific affidavit, a specific answer to an interrogatory to show that the plaintiffs knew the causal connection between their claims and the time they filed the case. That did not occur here. And that's why we believe that Judge Zell got it right in finding that there wasn't the specific evidence that the plaintiffs had not met the burden, and therefore summary judgment was properly granted. And I ask that this court affirm that decision.
Thank you, Mr. Madsen. Mr. Stitch, you have 5 minutes, sir.
Was sued out in July of 2004, and within a couple of months, we made a motion for summary judgment. At least two parties made a motion for summary judgment by October. That summary judgment motion was not heard for 13 months. It was a long period of time during which some discovery was taken and during which, in opposition to that motion, the plaintiffs filed affidavits, what has been referred to as the cookie-cutter affidavits. What happened, both as a result of the discovery that was done, there were some depositions taken, there were some interrogatories served and answered, and the affidavits, all of which were considered at the time of the summary judgment hearing, the plaintiffs just plain failed to come forward with the dates, when the discovery of the causal connection was made, how the connection was made, by whom it was made, basically the circumstances that would establish a time when the causal connection was made. Counsel takes issue with the procedure. However, the case was sued out. When it was sued out, the complaint, it had a number of allegations in it, but the complaint obviously, just by first glance at it, gave rise to the issue of statute of limitations, because we see things going back to the 40s. That's why the motion was made. The complaint doesn't provide any information with regard to the date of either the abuse or the injuries or that causal connection. Those are the things that had to be submitted, that were never submitted by the plaintiffs in response to the summary judgment motion. That's why Judge Zell granted that summary judgment motion. The plaintiffs had ample opportunity. Now, counsel says, well, we sent out interrogatories that ask about abuse and injury, and they did ask about those things. One of the reasons for asking about those things, of course, is the language of the statute of reasonably should have discovered. If we could get those dates of the abuse, the dates of the abuse, the injuries, and the treatment, there were also interrogatories about treatment, we put all those things together and perhaps had arrived at the date of when reasonably should have been discovered. So all of that was appropriate. All those interrogatories were discovered that was done was appropriate. What happened was we had a summary judgment motion that said, here, it appears that these are all subject to the statute of limitations. Plaintiff, in the normal course of events, how do you rebut that? Come forward with either answers to interrogatories, other discovery, or affidavits, which is the normal way of opposing a summary judgment motion. You put in those affidavits the operative facts that would get you past the motion for summary judgment, and it just plain wasn't done in this case.
Thank you, Mr. Fitch. Mr. Ford, you have 5 minutes, sir.
Please, the court, Michael Ford on behalf of the Oblate Sisters of the Blessed Sacrament. I think, Your Honors, this is essentially a gatekeeper case. Judge Zell was confronted with 72 claims that had been presented to him, and the defendants were saying that some of these claims aren't going to eventually get to fruition. Counsel points out or argues or complains that he came in late in the day, and that's true, he did. I mean, in fairness to Mr. Yates, he didn't start this particular exercise. But at the hearing on the motion for summary judgment on page 85, line 7, the court asked me the following question. I gave the following response, because Judge Zell was very much concerned about depriving people of their day in court. He wanted to make sure the meritorious claims had a chance. And here's what he said to me. Wouldn't it be fair to say, Mr. Ford, you're asking, not just you, the defendants, are asking this court to shut the doors on the plaintiffs without necessarily having all the facts, at least that can be elicited in front of me? My response, that's true, Your Honor, that's true. Wasn't it the plaintiffs and the counsel's obligation to come forward and saying, it seems to me like a simple thing to do, to simply come forward in some fashion, by affidavit or by deposition, saying, quote, I recovered the memory and connected the abuse or injury back in 1990 or 2001. And what happened, triggered it for me is this, close quote. Pretty simple, straightforward thing to do. If they'd done that, then we have to get into depositions and further discovery to see if that's true or not true. But I submit it would be a better use of everybody's resources to focus on the people that can make that claim, and a lot of them haven't done it. Now, at the time that those words were spoken, we had 72 claimants. As the court has already pointed out, a lot of them were alleging general abuse. We couldn't tell if it was psychological abuse based on beatings, sexual abuse. And so Mr. Stitch and I brought motions early on to find out which is which. Discovery then ensued. 13 months go by. Affidavits are filed. The plaintiffs had four opportunities to address this issue. In their summons and complaint, their answers to interrogatories, the affidavits they submitted in response to the Rule 56 motion, and finally, and most tellingly, in the affidavits that Mr. Yates submitted in support of his motion to amend. No place in the record, scoured as we may, can we find the information that is needed to get this case within 26-10-25.
But if he's right, that it's your burden, what did you do to establish that this statute applied?
I believe, Your Honor, that the case law in this state has been that once we show that it comes within the general statute of limitations, more than 3 years, it's incumbent upon the defendant to show that there's an exception to it. I think the burden shifts to the plaintiff. Now, if Mr. Yates is right, and the burden stayed with us, and we
have... That's what I'm asking, right.
Right. If Mr. Yates is right, then you have to reverse. Because Judge Zell found, and we contend, I believe it's the law in this case, that once we established that these cases were filed too long ago, it was his obligation to come within 26-10-25 to show that the connection between the injury and the causative act occurred within 3 years of his filings. And that should be a simple thing to do. Presumably, before you started the lawsuit, you would have ascertained that to begin with.
Well, I'm curious to know if your co-counsel agrees with your statement about we have to reverse if we agree with Mr. Yates that this is not an exception. I'd like to hear what other counsel say about right. that.
I'm not sure if they'd agree with that.
Well, I don't think you can admit for their sake, but it's kind of an interesting question, you know, whether even if the judge was wrong about the exception, does the passage of time at some point dictate the requirement? That's what I'm struggling with.
I would put it this way, Your Honor. The judge, Judge Giselle, was struggling to find a triable issue of fact to foist upon a jury and get them to decide. And try as he might, he couldn't find one. It was a simple fact that the cases were filed well beyond the normal statute of limitations, yet there was no fact that he could present to a jury or ask a jury to decide as to when the connection was made. That's, to me, the essence of a summary judgment order. And I think that's what Judge Zell was looking at when he was looking at 72 claimants and saying to himself, if these folks can't come up with it now, why should I foist this case upon a jury? I have nothing further unless the courts have additional questions.
Thank you, Mr. Ford. Mr. Murphy, you have 5 minutes, sir.
May it please the court. My name is Jeremiah Murphy. I'm a lawyer from Sioux Falls, South Dakota. I represent the Diocese of Sioux Falls. The Diocese of Sioux Falls has never owned, operated, or controlled St. Paul's Indian Mission School at Marty. The Diocese of Sioux Falls controls, operates, if you will, 24 Catholic schools in East River, South Dakota. The Diocese of Sioux Falls is East River. And that would include, for example, St. Joseph's School on the top of the hill above the Capitol, which is on the grounds of St. Peter and Paul Catholic Parish. Now, the diocese controls those in this manner. That's a Catholic parish, and so that's a corporation. It's a not-for-profit corporation. That's organized by five people, and it has a board of five directors from day one till today. And those directors are the bishop, the chancellor, or the vicar general, both normally priests. Today our chancellor is not a priest, but he is the bishop's chancellor.
But the school in question here is, correct me if I'm wrong, but from reading the briefs, it seems that when these orders, like for example the Blue Cloud Abbey wanted to establish an order in South Dakota, that they did have to have some kind of ecclesiastical permission from the bishop.
They did.
And that, but that's the only connection. The bishop could not hire or fire these teachers who were the alleged perpetrator.
That's correct. That's correct. But I did want to show you how he controls the 24 schools that he does that aren't diocesan schools. He does it with a five-person corporation. Three of the five persons he controls. One is himself. One is either his vicar general, chancellor, and one is the pastor, and two lay persons. So he controls each one of those 24 schools, and that's how he does it. He has superintendent of schools and things like that. The school that we're talking about is a mission school. It's controlled by an order of priests from day one that was established by the Benedictine Fathers from St. Meinrad's Abbey in St. Meinrad, Indiana. St. Meinrad had a connection to South Dakota.
So if this ever gets to a jury, the jurors are going to be delving fairly heavily into Catholic theology, it sounds like.
It shouldn't get there, because I'm not talking about theology. I'm talking about civil law. These schools are owned by corporations, and the ones that the bishop owns are corporations that he controls. Now then, the Benedictine corporations have no bishop representative or no bishop on it. And in 54, and it's in the record, the parish and school, if you will, admission at Marty was incorporated. And there were three incorporators. And the articles of incorporation said there shall be three directors, and they shall be these incorporators. Three gentlemen's names were listed. After each name were the initials OSB, OSB, OSB. That means Order of St. Ben's. That means they were Benedictine priests. They were the entirety of the board of directors of the corporation that operated that school. I'm only talking about civil law. I'm not talking about canon law.
Are you arguing from your own information and belief, or is there record evidence of what you've said here as far as who owns what and when?
There is. There is record evidence that there are 24 diocesan schools. The bishop, in the bishop's affidavit, he explains how he does that. He does that with the parish corporation. The parish owns the schools, and he tells how those parishes are organized. Everything I've said is from the record. The articles of incorporation of the Indian school in 54 are in the record. It's also in the record that finally in 75, when they turned that school over to the Indians, that in the preface of their agreement, it was written that the Marty Indian School Corporation is still owned 100% by the Benedictine Fathers.
I want to ask you another question on a different subject. You argued in your brief, and it's an intriguing question for me. You say in your brief that this statute, that when we're talking about here, only applies to perpetrators, and I see that we have an identical statute to the state of Washington and the state of Rhode Island, and those courts have come to opposite conclusions. Washington looked at it and with a split decision, 5-4, they said no, it applies to more than just the perpetrators. And then Rhode Island looked at it, and I think they were unanimous that this same language only applies to the perpetrators. You know, what do you have to say about that to give us some clue about what the legislature meant to do when they created this statute?
Well, I would start by saying that Colorado filed the other way in a similar statute.
Right, it's somewhat similar, but
then that's cited in the brief also. And I just think the totality of that statute says that it doesn't apply to institutions, but it applies to perpetrators. And I can tell you, in my opinion, bad facts make bad law, and some of the facts are terrible. And I think some courts stretched to pull that in.
Your time has expired, Mr. Murphy. Thank you very much. Mr. Yates, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Issue of the master servant, or shall I say, the control aspects of the diocese over St. Paul Marty Mission. The deposition testimony of the sisters established control. by the diocese, by the bishop himself, as a matter of fact, of every aspect of the mission. The diocesan bishop had the authority to approve or disapprove the diocesan, the mission's pastors, monks, and any other of the employees. St. Paul was a diocesan parish. A sister handled, a diocesan sister handled the abuse claims. Bishop Carlson himself testified that when Blue Cloud of Appia assigns a priest, he must have faculties granted by the bishop. He further testified that he received the accusations of priest sexual abuse and reviewed the personnel files of the priests who were accused.
You're talking about present or back before 1970?
Actually, the last point, Justice Kohnkamp, I'm talking about the only evidence we have is that he did that present time.
Right. Okay. But there's terms of the having a sister assigned to this and the reviewing the abuse. These are things that are present, or did that happen before 1975?
The 2000 time frame. We don't have any evidence.
Okay, because all of this stuff came out between then, and yes. I realize the Catholic Church has changed a lot of things since then.
Yes.
But in terms of the time frame we're talking about here, these things didn't exist that you're...
No, but the control that I referred to was there. And every aspect, not just the standpoint of it, and I'd like to address Justice Gilbertson's question, or as I understood it was a question on the entanglement, but every aspect of the various, the Blue Cloud of Abbey, the other, Kelly's present before the court visit, was controlled by the diocese, the bishop himself.
The bishop had the power to hire and fire these teachers?
As a matter of point in fact, I can't say hire and fire, but I know that they have to be approved, and to the extent if they're working under the auspices of Blue Cloud of Abbey, Blue Cloud of Abbey has to get faculties from an approval to act as a priest from the bishop himself. So I think there's an issue of fact on that, and as to the control, as to the entanglement, unless the court would determine that the law, the child and sex abuse law, doesn't regulate conduct which is both neutral on its face and purpose, then there isn't an entanglement, and there's not really a First Amendment issue in this case. As to the application to perpetrators, the statute itself says based on, and this was addressed in the DeLonga decision, it clearly reflects the legislative intent that since it's based on intentional conduct brought by any person for injury, suffering, childhood sexual abuse, the plain meaning of the words based on would mean that it applies to a type of harm. Also,
but you know, the DeLonga decision didn't address some other language that both, I think, the Washington Supreme Court and the Rhode Island Court did address. It's in 26:10-29, where it says, childhood sexual abuse is any act committed by the defendant. And both the minority of the four justices in Washington and the court in Rhode Island focused on that word the and said the, when the legislature used that, meant to say that only the perpetrators were the ones that we were opening the door to these extended statutes of limitations. How do you address that?
Well, I think that that's overridden by the fact that in 26:10-29, it also reflects that an intent to go back to culpable parties under prior law, and again, based on, would reflect that it refers to a type of harm, just as common.
If we disagree with you on that point, if we decided that it only applied to perpetrators, would that end your case, or do you still have some? Because I don't think you're suing any of the perpetrators. You're suing their superiors. Would that end your case?
No, because there would still be the concept of respondeat superior, master servant, principal agent.
Well,
that's not
they're not perpetrators. We're talking perpetrators. They wouldn't be perpetrating, would they?
Yes.
You're saying they would be.
That would. Yes, Your Honor. The way the appellants look at this, this was a dismissal basically by ambush because, and I'm not making any personal accusations here, counsel in this case, their briefs, by the way, if anything was said to the contrary, would be interpreted contrary, were extremely well written and showed a high degree of lawyer-like analysis, but the fact of it is, as I previously addressed, the plaintiffs just didn't have an opportunity. This was a motion to dismiss. I believe an appropriate analogy might be, if I may, a plaintiff files a will contest case, and the defendant claims entitlement under the laws of intestate succession, and never even addresses the existence of the will, and the plaintiff says, no, this is a will contest. Here's my will. And the court makes finding that he grants a dismissal based upon the fact that the plaintiff didn't prove up the terms of his will. I submit this court would likely reverse that dismissal. The movement defendant has to not only assert the statute of limitations, they have to presumptively establish it. And again, they didn't presumptively establish anything here, except that the victims of childhood sexual abuse, so many of them didn't have repressed memories. They remembered it. As far as the policy behind the statute of limitations, it's been legislatively and judicially noted that it doesn't apply to the sexual abuse of children cases. Basically, to hold otherwise would provide a safe haven to pedophiles and those who enlist them. It's, in this case, under the cloak of godly authority. The children who were victimized in this case, Your Honors, adult survivors still reside in those, each one of those children. They've grown into adulthood with emotionally stunted manifestations of the abuse they endured, and at this seed level of their development, they regardless of the cultivation they might have received after that, they still have the scars. Thank you, Your Honor. In closing, all adults, we're all teachers of children and our grandchildren, and take on the title, trust, responsibility of being a teacher of other people's children. And Henry Adams said a grand thing that a teacher can affect eternity. He never knows where his influence will end. And my question is, it was in law school as a skeptical thinker, you know, which way does that cut? And based upon experience in these cases, I would amend that great quote to something to the effect that a teacher's influence, you never know where it's going to stop, for good or for ill. And in this case, actually, there's been a documentary on this past week in TV where, simply called The War, where elderly men, war heroes, were paralyzed and utterly speechless when it came to trying to articulate the horrors that they'd experienced 60 years ago. And the horrors are transgenerational. They affect eternity. There may or may not be a statute that may or may not be rightly construed in this case, Your Honors, but there's no limitation on the suffering and the horrors of childhood sexual abuse. The horrors and the betrayal are transgenerational. They go on and on and on and on until justice finally prevails. But perhaps the law consoles us, or can console us, and teach us how to walk in balance. Although 26.10.25, this statute, child sexual abuse in this state, is not a tolling statute from an appellate standpoint.
Your time has expired, counsel. Thank you. Court will be in recess for 10 minutes.